It's Men in Black in the Old West, but way more racist. We saw Wild Wild West, so you know what that means.
Now it's time for How Did This Get Made? We're gonna have a good time, celebrate some failure, not just be a hater, because you know you wonder, how did this get made? Let's wallow in the mediocrity of subpar art. Perhaps we'll find the answer to the question, how did this get made?
Hello, people of Earth, and welcome to How Did This Get Made? We have a very fun show for you today. The movie is Wild Wild West. I am joined by my two co-hosts, Jason Mantzoukas. How are you?
Pretty good. All right, Paul.
And June Diane Raphael. How are you?
Hi, Paul.
Both back in the studio, and today a very special guest, writer, director, podcaster, Kevin Smith. Welcome.
This is just a proactive way to make sure none of my flicks ever get discussed on this fucking show.
Pretty genius.
The moment I saw this podcast pop up, I said, I gotta get on that show fast. Otherwise, it's gonna be like episode 16, Jersey Girl. How the fuck did this happen? So now you'll have to think twice.
By the way, before that happens. We'll do Jersey Girl if
but
you're
have
the guest.
Yeah, totally. Okay. Oh, because I could tell you what happened there.
Oh, perfect. That's a great version of this show.
This one, I don't have as much insight into how it happened, but I do play. To say a role would be putting it too grand.
Well, you play Will Smith's role in this movie, right?
I play what nobody ever realized is how black
really
good.
Really?
And nobody gave me any credit, you know? Because they were still mad about Mallrats. This is a movie that I have such tangential connection to.
But when I heard about this, it made me laugh so hard. I mean, so the big thing in this movie is the end piece is a gigantic 80-foot mechanical spider.
Totally normal.
Yeah, totally normal.
Which, to be fair, before we skewer to flick, when you saw this trailer, you were like, holy shit, they may have cracked the code.
Yeah.
Like, this may be the best movie of all time. They found a way to combine the Old West and fucking steampunk and all this stuff.
And the track record's great. You got Men in Black. He's been, Will Smith has been, like, Independence Day. You're like, all right, these guys,
Barry fucking Sonnenfeld, man. Like, great. A legendary director, hell of a shooter. Like, he knows how to work humorously.
Yeah.
Big and budget.
Huge racist.
Great. I mean, and also, like, a good movie to be translated, or a good TV show to be translated into a movie.
Sure.
It's like, has anybody ever watched the TV show?
Yeah. No, oh, I haven't.
Oh, the TV show's great. It's like James Bond in the Old West. I mean.
And who was the star?
Robert Conrad.
Conrad.
Who?
So the dude who was like, put a battery on my fucking shoulder.
Knock
that shit off.
Is the TV show a two-hander, like the movie?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, okay. And basically,
Don't be dropping in the fucking industry lingo and whatnot. You lost me. We lost half the audience going, two-hander? Is this a porn?
Two-hander?
Is this the first episode of a meet cute?
Explain two-hander for those who
they
have
just
no
hold
clue.
Hands the entire time.
It's an equal balance.
I didn't know it was going to be one of these shows.
Oh, yeah. No.
This is like fucking a Nikki Fink
so
column.
Sorry.
Yeah, told you.
Yes, told an industry. It's sickening.
Well, you know two-hander. What? It was supposed to be at one point Mel Gibson and George Clooney was the original incarnation of the Wild Wild West, but then Richard Donner was going to direct it. He went off and did Maverick, and then he took
Mel Gibson with him.
Exactly. He made, like, I think I remember liking Maverick. I haven't watched it recently, but
I remember not liking Maverick.
Maverick, all I remember is Jodie Foster's chemistry with him, and more so than the movie itself. And this is, I guess, when, like, publicity and hype machines started actually going to work in a big bad way. 'Cause there was an era, kids, before the age of podcasts and the internet, where you didn't know that much about movies unless you went fucking digging for it in a zine or a convention.
I remember being on AOL online and downloading, like, movie posters for, like, Beverly Hills Cop 3, and it was, like, slowly just
really?
Coming down.
Oh,
like,
my God.
It was almost like masturbating to porn.
Yeah, just, like,
watch line
by
line.
What does it look like?
Is that a roller coaster in the background? Oh, Axel, put a banana in its tailpipe. This will be amazing. But there was a period where you didn't know that much, that you weren't inundated. It wasn't like, you know, now during the production of a movie, you hear about it all throughout.
Images
all during
are
post.
Leaked. Yeah.
You're seeing shit left and right. This was when they started, like, putting stars out there big time and doing, like, and again, it's not like this is where it was born, but this is where I felt it, like, kick in, where publicity became an art form all to itself and an industry almost as powerful as the financiers in this business and the marketers. Publicity is just as powerful. Jodie Foster went out and told this story a zillion fucking times about what a prankster
Mel Gibson
was.
On Maverick.
Yes.
Yeah.
Always. Anytime you heard about Maverick, it wasn't about, like, oh, it's the old show or fucking James Garner makes an appearance. None of that. It was Mel Gibson is such a practical joker, and Jodie Foster is going to tell you how. And she's like three very tame examples, but also kind of cute. We were like, oh, who knew he had a sense of humor?
Yeah.
That's all I remember of Maverick. Cut 2 years later when they're like, Mel Gibson hates Jewish people. All I can
and
think
gays.
Of, and gays as well. All I can think about is like, what? So what were those practical jokes? Yes.
There was a lot that did not make the story, the publicity story.
Inexplicably, yeah. Jodie Foster is Mel Gibson's greatest apologist. Yeah,
she's like still, a staunch defender of
but
him.
She's becoming the person that comes out in defense of anybody that goes off the path.
And Kristen Stewart.
She just did it with Casey too as well. Yeah. She comes out going, leave her alone. She just likes fucking dick. I shouldn't say that. But
by the way, how great would it have been if Jodie Foster was like, leave her alone. She likes fucking dick.
Of all people. She's like, I don't.
To each his own. Or her own, I guess.
Or bone, if you will.
It's like, but you're right. Like, this is like the era of, it was 1999, like where it was like, where Godzilla had like all summer long, was like, it's coming. It's bigger than this bus.
They have a billboard in New York on the side of a building. It would be like, he's bigger than this.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
But this movie,
it was terrible.
It's so bad.
And what they forgot was to put up an ad that was like, it's as interesting. About an inch between
and two. And it's this giant, but a scratch and sniff sticker of a fart.
But the problem with that movie is like, you take Godzilla, which is a design everybody fucking knows fundamentally, and change it. It would be like if they did that Smurfs movie, and whether you saw it or not, you looked at the poster, you're like, that looks like a fucking Smurf. Did you do it?
Yeah.
They look like Smurfs.
Yes. They do look like Smurfs.
Those are Smurfs.
Godzilla doesn't look like Godzilla.
Yeah, you can't change what the character is. You have to keep in there.
And then insist to people that it's the same thing.
Yeah. This movie, so bad that Robert Conrad was asked to cameo in the Wild Wild West because he was a star of the TV show, and he said no. And then accepted all the Razzie Awards for the Wild Wild West. Because he hated the movie so much. And then Will Smith eventually apologized to Robert Conrad for wrecking the Jim Smith character.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
Do you think that's even owed?
I don't think he needs to go and apologize to Robert Conrad. It's
like, did Robert Conrad create that show?
No, yeah.
He played the character for the first time, right?
Yeah. I think
I'm not saying, and I don't want to pick a fight because he must be 70. He must be a tough guy, and he'll come in and be like,
put the
fucking battery on my shoulder, knock it off, you bitch. That was the commercial of my youth. He was the scary guy who was like, knock a Duracell off my
totally.
And for some reason, that would prove that it was a better battery than most.
Tougher battery.
You could get in my face, then this is a good battery. And you're like, what's the logic?
I'm gonna buy that battery. You're gonna do that battery.
This is before they decided to market things based on how good they were. This was just like associating them with tough guys.
Well, then they had the rabbit. And all of a sudden they had the bunny, and people were like, fuck you and your fucking shoulder.
Well, what was that?
This rabbit will sell batteries, way more batteries.
What about that guy? Wasn't there that Australian guy who sold batteries too? Like,
oh, the big bald guy?
Yeah.
That was
Jacko. Oi, that guy.
Again, nothing to do with batteries. Just really
anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
Because he was like, oi, oi, oi. No, he was Australian. That was their thing.
It was their oi.
Their oi.
Not the Jewish oi. Although he might be Jewish.
Maybe.
We don't know.
We don't know.
Is
we
there
need
not
to find out about
the international language of oi? Like, that it goes to all cultures?
Well, I mean, Gwen Stefani had that oi to the world. She did have on. It was
it's on the
best Christmas album.
I
like
feel
that
like kind of that's the oi of punk rock British, Aussie, same oi, you know, that would be from that era, from that
but
version.
Maybe that's what Jocko's oi was.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure it was.
That oi still lives, man. I was at we had an event once, a Vulgarthon, and there's a lineup before people get in, and there were these three dudes who were like their own homegrown punk band, and I'm walking down the line, going, hey, welcome everybody, welcome. They stopped me like, dude, you got to hear this because we wrote this with you in mind. Ready? And they fucking pull out a guitar, boom, sing oi for Captain America, and they did 5 minutes of punk about singing oi for Captain America and how awesome he was. And mind you, this is like 1999.
Yeah,
these guys were ahead of the curve. I like it.
Yeah, these guys
got late
it on.
And a little early.
Yeah.
So, this movie was. Everyone, I think, expected this movie to be great. The track record was lining up perfectly, and it's an example of one of those movies that has like all the right elements in place, but it's just a mishmash of nothing.
Nothing.
Six writers on this movie, two story by credits, like two separate people wrote the story, and then six different writers are credited. That's a hard thing to even get done in the WGA to get that many writers.
Let's look at how many cooks may have been involved in this.
Yeah.
If you're coming off of Men in Black, you've got, of course, Will Smith. He's at his apex at this point. And Barry Sonnenfeld, the director, is also at probably his most powerful.
Yeah.
Who else is in the movie? Kevin Kline doesn't have that much juice, and by all reports, has always been a guy who's like, I'm an actor, I'm here to do the work.
And actually really good in this movie, too.
Sells it.
So, Kenneth Branagh,
he doesn't have enough juice to mess with
But
things.
This is a weird move for him at that time,
yeah.
I feel like.
I'm sure he was just like, this will make me hip.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like
Kevin Kline was great.
The moment I knew we were doing this, I was brushing up on Branagh. Wait till you hear my Kevin Kline.
Listeners, Kenneth Branagh is not in the studio. That was Kevin Smith.
But this is like, you know, this is like that Jeff Goldblum doing Independence Day and Jurassic Park. It's like, this is my big ticket.
Yep.
Like I'm a
normally
this
I'm
actor.
An actor, and now I'm going to be this actor.
Exactly. I'll just jump into this movie. And yeah, you imagine all the Warner Brothers people. And it's like it's the most expensive movie made in 1999. This movie. Mm. So that also says that there's a lot of
Salma
people.
Hayek, juice whatsoever.
No juice at that
point. So really the responsibility, if you're going to play a blame game, probably falls squarely on the shoulders of
Emmett Walsh.
And Emmett Walsh. Good point, man. The guy, everything
he's the train conductor.
Turns to shit.
Yeah, the minute I see Emmett Walsh, I'm like, fuck.
This guy
yeah.
came in with a
It is
a
all about Emmett.
Notes.
Raising Arizona could have been amazing, but the first 5 minutes,
blew it.
Emmett Walsh.
Blood simple. Oh, come on, Emmett Walsh.
Come on.
Shot by Barry Sonnenfeld, actually.
Slapshot. Ooh, well done. Well connected.
Yeah, right.
I would also argue, too, that there is one flaw in this movie. There's many. Like, when they rewrote it for a black actor to play this role, it is a little odd to be like, he's an undercover agent right after the Civil War. He would stick out like a sore thumb wherever he would go.
Everywhere.
Yes, and the rewrites in this movie are so evident. Like, they don't have anything to do with the plot at all. Like, making him, you know, that character played by a black actor. It's just sort of integrated into the lines here and there.
Yeah.
Oh, it's not here and there. Every time he comes, every time.
Also, every time he enters a scene.
Yeah.
Like, it smells like they had a test screening and everyone responded and they're like, just more of this, less of that.
Yes.
Having been through the fucking process, that's what happens, man. We talked about Jersey Girl before, but Jersey Girl is the movie I test screened the most, was forced to. 12 separate times.
Oh, man. Ooh.
And when you start making cuts based on an audience reaction that you're never going to meet again, it's a slippery slope. I've always said, look, you bring me a crowd, and if they all say shit, I'll cut to their notes, but then give me that same exact crowd to then show them the second pass.
Because
otherwise, it makes no sense. But what they do is, you meet one audience, they go, this sucks, this blows, and the studio goes, you heard them, fucking fix it. So you go in and change it, and they're like, let's test it again. Then you test with a completely different audience, and you're not answering the old notes anymore, you're answering their all brand new notes.
Oh, it's a mess.
It's a terrible mess. So you go through, and you know, it's not as bad as like fucking Home Invasion, that's a terrible mess. Things like that. But
the idea of a real Home Invasion.
But at least
a really
the Home Invasion. Is not
that's hard disheartening.
A Home Invasion
scary.
Is never noted though. You get the go in, you do your stuff.
Nobody's ever like you could have done that better. But in that process, when you look at this flick, you have the same feeling. Like they sat there and screened it. The first screening, they were like, "This is gonna be money, jacked up. Here we go." And they got a bunch of fucking like revelatory notes. Were like, "Shit, take everything out that blows and everything that got a remote chuckle." Let's just throw money into
more. You're exactly right, because I did some research, and this movie tested so badly that it became a news story in the time where this wasn't a big deal.
Right.
And Barry Sonnenfeld and Will Smith had to come out in front of that bad test screening and be like, and Barry Sonnenfeld's thing was, people thought they were seeing The Matrix. That's why. They didn't know they were seeing a comedy movie. I've read the whole article today.
I've thought of so many excuses for why my films underperform, but never have I thought to say, somebody thought this was something completely different.
People
set in the future, not the old
misunderstanding.
West.
Misunderstanding.
Yeah, this is not my fault.
Nothing more than for every time you test screen a movie now, you come out in front of it and say, people thought they were seeing The Matrix.
I am so,
always
yeah.
The Matrix, though. Always
The Matrix. They thought it was going to be in 3D and IMAX. But just to give you a sense of how the dialogue kind of plays, this is Will Smith, who is a black man, talking to a man who is cripple, and you will hear how they just go back and forth.
Well, a man who plays a cripple.
Yes, man who plays a cripple. Yes,
important distinction.
Yes. Here we go.
How nice of you to join us tonight and add color to these monochromatic proceedings.
Boom, one.
Well, when a fella comes back from the dead, I find that an occasion to stand up.
Zing.
He counted.
Miss East informs me that you're expecting to see General McGrath here. Well, I knew him years ago, but I haven't seen him in a coon's age.
Oh, Zing.
Holy crap.
Well, I can see where it'd be difficult for a man of your stature to keep in touch with Zing. Even half the people you know.
Zing.
Perhaps the lovely Miss East will keep you from being a slave to your disappointment.
Zing.
I didn't know.
That is this one little scene.
And that
scene
dynamic.
Five times.
Yeah, that dynamic between them happens throughout the movie.
Yes. I don't think that's fair to. You can't attack someone for their race, and your comeback is, well, you're handicapped.
Yeah.
Because then on one level, you're going, well, I guess my race is kind of a handicap.
Yeah.
Or I guess I equate your handicap with a race. Yeah. Like, there's no. Like, you can't attack on that level.
Yeah, it's.
He would have had to just done a bunch of white jokes.
Yeah.
And then it would have been like, fucking been all
fine.
The
yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's they don't cripple people and black people do not get out well in this movie at all.
But they're also like cripples and black people. They're not like the cats and dogs of humanity.
No, yeah,
where
that's
they're
not
like,
the
finally,
constant, yeah.
We've pit them head together to in a movie you've always wanted to see.
Half a man versus a black man.
Scrap it out.
You know that they hate each other.
Half a man.
Well, and by the way, that's the first time that Will Smith and Kenneth Branagh meet in this movie. And there's also like a little funny scene here too, because you know Will Smith is trying to steal some documents, and you find out that Kenneth Branagh's office is full of paintings that like his security guard standing in the painting,
posed as parts of paintings,
living paintings,
yes. Living paintings.
That's right.
But that's how rich he is.
Yeah, and they don't kill him when he's in there by himself. Only
Wait for him to like scan the paper, learn the information. They wait for a very long time to get him, and then they don't get him.
Yeah,
he manages to somehow shoot them all.
Yeah, he shoots. He realizes that every painting is in there.
Yeah.
It's a really waste
even
of security.
Even the one on the ceiling.
Yeah,
down
oh my god.
Very end.
But. So there's so much to talk about.
Oh, wait.
Here.
We still haven't heard Kevin's story.
Yeah. So obviously, the producer of this movie,
the
one
producer
of the.
This movie was John Peters, who goes back in this town, in this business for.
This is Streisand's John Peters, right?
Yes. Streisand's John Peters.
Hairdresser.
Back in the day, he was a hairdresser. That's how he's gained entree into this business. He was Barbara Streisand's hairdresser, who then became.
It's an unusual trajectory.
Yeah. Isn't it weird? Especially because when you think of her hair, you go, especially. Then, circa 70s,
yeah.
Like, oh, it's that fucking rat's nest. Of,
yeah.
Like, it's literally just a fro.
Yes, it is.
It is
what,
literally
what work
a rat's
is
nest.
Being done there? So, he was her hairdresser, and then he became her lover. If you
oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that.
I like that you brought it down together. There.
Yeah.
Then he became her
the lights, I'll
lover.
Tell you
interesting trajectory.
Yes. And then... She started bringing him onto flicks as her producer.
He like produced A Star Is Born. He executive producer on Caddyshack.
A main event he put her into. That was the boxing movie with Ryan O'Neal.
Yeah. I mean, he has great movies. I mean, you know, American Werewolf in London, Flashdance, DC Cab, Youngblood, Caddyshack 2. No.
The Shack is back.
Batman. Tango and Cash, Batman Returns.
This is what I know he's definitely responsible for. The main event, because he can talk about that to no end. And Batman. He was heavily involved with Batman.
Oh, really? Okay.
I spent a lot of time with him because I was working. I got a job in 1996 working on Superman Returns, it was called. Oh,
now,
Superman
was it,
Reborn.
You weren't going to put Tim Burton in the suit.
But I suggested, like, again, my opinion didn't mean shit at that point. Right. Like, Chasing Amy, I think, had yet to even come out. I was coming off Mallrats. But when I handed in my script, I was like, you guys should get Tim Burton, man. He did a great job with Batman.
Yeah.
Even though his sensibility is different than fucking, you know, Batman, yeah. Superman, the character. Like, that dude knows that. Because there were nobody else that you can point to be like, there's a comic book guy. But at the point that I was involved with it, nobody... was attached yet. Tim Burton would come later. Nick Cage would come later on as well. But when I was working on it, I had to go meet with Peters in order to go through the approval process because when he used to run Warner Brothers with Peter Guber. And then, I'm sorry, They were at Warner Brothers during Batman. Movie went fucking huge. Over on the other side of town, the Japanese buy Sony.
Okay.
And then they say, we need someone to run this studio. Let's just turn to the premier producers who made the most successful movie of this year. And they brought Peter Guber. They bought them out of their Warner Brothers contracts. brought them to Sony and had them run the studio. If you're interested in this kind of shit, there's an amazing book called Hit and Run, which is all about Goober Peters taking over Sony and running it into the ground, and the Japanese fleeing Hollywood in a big bad way, because they're like, this is a fool's errand.
Yeah,
just a hole to put money into. So those dudes wound up with golden parachutes dropping out of Sony when it was in its worst financial conditions in years. And they landed separately. John Peters landed with an overall deal at Warner Brothers. One of the two projects he requested when he came in the door was the Muhammad Ali story and Superman. And I can't say this is why, but I've been to his office.
Yeah.
And if you recall, back in the 70s, there was an issue of Superman where he fought Muhammad Ali.
Oh, no.
And he had a giant blow-up in his office framed of those two characters fighting.
Oh, wow.
And I often suspect he was just like, what will my next two movies be? And he goes, here it is. So he was the guy. And so I had to go meet with him. And when they sent me to meet with him, I was warned, like, he's a bit eccentric. And, you know, he's going to tell you some things that he wants in the movie that we don't. But go meet with him, blah, blah, blah. You got to get, he's the guy. If he likes you, you're on the job. We like you here at the studio. He's got to like you. So you go to meet him. And he literally lives in an estate, like here in Hollywood, it was over in Beverly Hills, that is reminiscent of going up to Batman's house, to Bruce Wayne's house. Like, very large property. And this is 96 at this point, so I haven't been around big affluent properties at this early in my career. This is the biggest one I'd seen. You get in and there's a fucking butler and maid, and somebody parks your car, and there's like stables and shit, like grounds. It was crazy.
Yeah.
So they bring me into a living room, and he comes in. He's got his like tennis shorts on, and he's tan and shit, and he's very affable, but very like, I know who I am. I run Hollywood kind of guy.
Yeah.
He sits me down. He goes, so they tell me that you like Superman? Like, let me hear it. I didn't see the movie. And this is all coming off of Mallrats. Because in Mallrats, I made a joke about Superman. Yeah. They were like, you know a lot about Superman. I swear to God.
That was it?
I met with an exec named Basil Iwanek, who's gone on to do cool things. Yeah. I think he works with Ben on like on his last movie, on the Town or something. But when I met with him, he's a junior exec. And they had a few projects. They were like, we've got this one called, it was remember the end of the Watchmen? It was based on an episode of The Outer Limits. I think it was called Architects of Fear.
Okay.
They had that. It was an episode of Outer Limits that they wanted to do as a feature. And they gave me a script, which to this day, I can't remember who wrote it. But they gave me the script to read. They're like, this is just weird. Like, see if you could do anything with this. And I read it. It was hands down one of the best scripts I've ever read in my life. And I handed it back. I was like, this is flawless. You should make this.
Yeah.
And they're like, it's an art film. And it kind of was. It was definitely more of like a Chris Nolan type of action flick than anything else. And which in those days would have been a tough fucking sell. So I like that. I was like, I got nothing for this. I think you should just make this. And they're like, we're not going to. and they offered me two other things. One was Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian, which I was I love Beetlejuice, but I was like, I think we said everything we need to say.
I love just Goes Hawaiian. That is like
alone. Literally, that was what they wanted
to
do.
Did they have a script for that?
They had one that looked like this. There was already a draft, and they wanted me to go in. I was like, I ain't gonna be that guy.
Man.
I also came in with, like, I liked working. I was happy to be in the business, but I also didn't want to be the guy that was like the person I would have made fun of if I hadn't had Clerks picked up. Like, who the fuck does a Beetlejuice sequel without Tim Burton? You know, that guy. So I said no to that. And he said, there's one more that's a real long shot, but we're trying to redevelop Superman. I was like, oh, Superman, I know comics and shit. And he's like, yeah. And I was like, yeah, man, I talked about, I'm in Mallrats, like the Brody character's a big fan of comic books. And he goes, that's why you're here. I said, why? He goes, because someone saw Mallrats and said, like, you talk about Superman and a kryptonite condom? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, well, they figured you had an original take on Superman.
Oh my God.
I was like, that's not even an original take, man. That's based on an essay called Man of Steel, Woman of Tissue or something like that from back in the day. They're like, well,
I
want to
read
room.
That essay, by the way. I didn't know that. That's a
fantastic essay. It wasn't even based on that. Years later, somebody was like, did you ever read Man of Steel, Woman of Tissue? I said, no. They said, in it, they talk about how Superman and Lois couldn't have sex because his sperm would like kill her fallopian tubes.
Yeah.
Mine was based on an issue of a comic book, a Superman annual that must have been taken from that.
Sure.
And in the story, on the cover, I can't remember what issue it is, but Superman is making out with Maxima on the grave of Lois Lane. And in it, in the story, one of these Elseworlds stories, he has sex with Lois Lane and kills her because the his sperm didn't do it. She got pregnant, the baby kicked and killed her.
Oh, man.
So I always remember reading that issue and being like, that's fucked up. So when I was writing Mallrats, I included the joke about like kryptonite con and blast through her back like a shotgun. And because of that, they were like, you know something about Superman. So
I sat down and the something you know is sexy.
Yeah, we like what
we want some of that
Superman.
Fucking X-rated Superman condom shit in this movie.
Dude turns his lights down. He's just like, just tell me that story again.
Yeah. And I'll show you naked pictures of Streisand.
With a head of hair you wouldn't believe.
And a bush twice as big.
I tamed them both. First with my hand, then with my cock. I was like, can I go, man? It was really unnerving for me. I just want to work on Superman. But he goes, he listens to me. I don't have a pitch. They have a story they want to do, which is the death of Superman. There had already been a script before me written by Wesley Strick, which they didn't like. And I read it, and the thing that stuck out to me was that there was a moment where Superman goes into a therapist's office to be like, I'm Superman.
Yeah.
That would never happen. Yeah. That felt like a Hollywood beat. That's almost, to me, akin to Batman in The Dark Knight Rises. Everyone see that?
Yeah.
Okay, but spoilers if you haven't.
Yeah, there you go.
They're on the roof, and Catwoman's with them.
Oh, yeah.
And then she leaves, and then he turns around and goes, so that's what that feels like. That would never happen in a million years.
Yeah, yeah.
He would never do that. Why would he use that voice out loud if he was alone?
Well, that's the thing I thought of, too. Like, why is he talking to himself like that?
Dude, there's nobody here. He's like, yeah, you're right. Yeah. All right, yeah.
But it'd be so awesome if he was like, so that's what that feels like. Like, he has a third voice for when he's alone.
Or controversially, he went to like the quote unquote retard voice and was just like, that would be memorable, man. When people were like, holy crap.
Or if he's like, oh, fuck, you really did it again,
He is a Daniel Day-Lewis superhero. Okay? Yep. He gets into the character. Once he's in that costume, that's it.
Once the cowl is on, it is on.
The all sense goes away as it cuts off the brain part, and he decides to go with the voice. So I'm sitting there telling Peters, okay, I guess if you're going to do this, you do this. I wouldn't do this kind of stuff. I wouldn't, you know, be winking and knowing and shit in terms of like saying Superman's going to psychiatrist. So I'm all done with whatever my pitch is. And again, it's not really my pitch. It's based on fucking the storyline they want to do, which is the death of Superman. So he looks at me. He's sitting on his couch, big living room. He looks at me for a long, hard beat, man. And he goes, you and me are going to get Superman right. You know why? And at first I felt good because I was like, well, it sounds like I got a fucking job, man. I said, why? And he goes, because you and me, we understand Superman. Do you know why? And I said, no. He goes, because you and me are from the streets. Now,
he is from the streets originally.
Yeah. I don't know where he's from, but I am not from
hard knocks.
The streets that led to Barbara Streisand. Very hard streets. And I didn't want to say, like, grew up in the suburbs. This dude was a hairdresser. Neither of us know the streets. And he was literally, and also, remove that. What does fucking Superman have to do with the streets?
Not the least street smart character, really.
Exactly.
He's just an alien who's,
So he was a guy, I guess he'd come from not so much money, because he talked about, like, you know, I used to go to wherever city he lived in, that department store. He's like, and I used to go and just look at the window displays of the things they put up. One of those people with nothing looks at the image of something and goes, one day.
Very movie moment. His life is a movie.
A movie moment. He only brought this up because when I came in, there was a setup in the middle of his living room that I swear to God looked like the floor of Nordstrom's. There was a piano and there was like what looked like a display with sweaters and shirts on it.
No.
What, there was letters and shirts on it?
I'm not fucking kidding. And I thought, so I was like, when I were in the middle of the place, I was like, well, maybe they were doing some kind of benefit here or something like that. But he was explaining to me that he always dreamed about having displays.
Wow. This is really crazy, though, because on Oprah, Barbara Streisand was interviewed, and one of her homes, her entire basement is set up like a store. Like a department store.
Yeah,
where
it's
she
crazy.
She came from
rooms.
No money. Is she one of these like I came from nothing?
No, she came from nothing.
Way.
That is, I do know she came from nothing. And had like a horrible mother.
Yeah,
she has,
but
like,
it's a
terrible
funny
childhood.
Image to come from nothing. Instead of just buying a lot, you create a store.
No, that's very like, odd.
Maybe, I gotta get dressed today. I'm just gonna go downstairs and buy an outfit,
because I can.
That I already own.
You could literally make the argument like, she can't go to the store anymore, and maybe she misses the experience of like walking onto the floor. So she's created her own version. in a Truman Show-like way. But it really comes down to, like, I think it comes down to, we always saw this as being a sign of wealth.
Yeah.
And so once we had so much crazy wealth where we had a house and many cars and everything's taken care of and we're just looking for shit to buy,
yeah,
we start buying our childhood back or images of what we think we wanted.
I want to buy
that
kids. Nordstrom's.
And he did.
Oh my God.
It was
that would be the equivalent for me, I feel like, would be if I became incredibly wealthy and you came to my house and there was an arcade there.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that to me would be the equivalent. Like that
old
is what
stand up games.
I can't get my head around that.
Oh yeah.
Like that
yeah,
to
but
me
that
makes
to me
sense.
Was like, oh my God, can you imagine if you had
Dragon's Lair in my house?
Always had access to Joust.
Yeah.
But that's okay, but you got a bunch of arcade games in your house. That's almost like, hey, everyone take a turn.
Sure,
like,
sure,
we
yeah,
all
yeah.
Play. This ain't like
no. This is like a private.
Like, what kind of discount?
What kind of sweaters do you have? Cable knit? Ooh, I want these.
The best
cable
thing would be if he's out there and he's like, oh, none of these are my size.
That's how he keeps himself grounded.
Yeah.
He keeps on like he never is in his size.
I love this sweater, but it's sold out in my size.
He's the dude that's just like, as his wealth decreases, the displays decrease. So it goes from Nordstrom to like right now in his career, he's got a Ross set up.
Filene basement.
Filene into the other.
Pay less anyway, in the garage.
He was a very strange man.
So you're from the streets,
He's from the streets. I'm from the streets. He's the one essentially says, we're going to do this. And he, in the process of the movie, he had like notes that he wanted to do, which were very important. Number one, he goes, I don't want to see him in that suit, which he called, quote unquote, faggy. His word, not mine.
This is also an era of Superman where Superman has a different suit.
Yeah,
this is like late 90s Superman is completely different.
Some,
like
a little you've bit. Got, well, you had some of the black suit from during the death of.
And then you got that like electric one.
Yeah, that
exactly.
Blue one.
Electric as well. So he's going, I don't want to see the old suit. He goes, number two, I don't want to see him flying. I think that shit looks fake in movies. So right away, you're like, if he's not in the suit and he's not flying,
what do you got? Yeah, what do you have?
Do you want to just make Batman again? I'm into that.
Yeah.
And then his third thing was like, and he has to fight a giant spider in the third act. Swear to you. And I was like, really? He goes, yeah. He's going, man, do you know anything about spiders? I said, no. He goes, I watch a lot of Discovery Channel. He's going, I watch this documentary about spiders. Fiercest predators in the insect kingdom. Absolute killers. He's going, and when I was a kid, I went and saw King Kong. And in King Kong, there's a moment where the doors open up and they reveal not King Kong for the first time, but some other fucking monster or something like that. He's like, and it was horrifying. And I envision a moment in this movie where the doors open up and Superman has to fight this giant spider.
And a real spider, right?
Giant, like, real spider. So I'm like, okay, if that's the directive, that wasn't in the death of, and I've never seen that in the comics, but so be it. So I went back to the studio because they're like, report.
Oh yeah.
You know, what's going on over there? Because they're like, he's a nut bar. So I was like, well, he said this, and they go, oh, as if they've heard it before.
Right.
And then I say, and then also he talked about, and they go, wait, he wants to put a giant spider in the back. I said, yes, how weird is that? He said he watched Discovery. He's going, John and that fucking spider. That was Lorenzo De Bonaventure. He goes, John and that fucking spider. I was like, he's been trying
really
to do
familiar.
It. The dude was so into this spider thing. He tried to shoehorn it into the flick. And I was like, what do I do? And they were like, just call it anything but a spider. And I said, really? And they're like, just give him what he wants, but do not call it a spider, man. Research shows nobody cares about spider. And I was like, okay, what if I call it Thanagarian snare beast? They're like, perfect. So Thanagarian, I was like, right on, connects to Hawkman and shit like that. And so Peters was like, what is this? And I was like, it's a Thanagarian snare beast. He goes, what is that? I was like, giant spider in DC Comics. He goes, oh, perfect. So I put that in, and he, you know, worked on that for a little while. When I submitted the script, you can hear the entire story of that over at the first evening with Kevin Smith,
which is great.
I tell the long Superman story, but in the interest of moving on to fucking Wild Wild West, the project comes to an end for me. They bring on Tim Burton, and Tim Burton was like, I'm gonna start from scratch with my own script. He brought on somebody else, my shit goes to the wayside, and that was it. Never thought about it again. I mean, thought about like, man, I worked on Superman, but I got a great story out of it, and I was telling that story at Q&A's for years. Then it went on the DVD. And that was, like, to me, that was the end of it. Then, in 1999, I went to the movies to go see Wild Wild West, also produced by John Peters. And I'm watching the flick, and it is what it is, this bizarre little train wreck combination of many genres. But all of a sudden, this giant mechanical spider appears, man. And I was like, he got his spider. He finally got his spider. It took a him a long time, but he got a much more expensive one.
And it also doesn't really make sense.
Nope.
What was so great about that story is that it is so shoehorned in. It's like, okay, there's steampunk and there's stuff like that, but now we got this 80-foot giant fucking spider.
As if the giant spider, and the presumption in the movie, what the movie contends is that Kenneth Branagh's possession of this giant spider is enough to bring the United States to its knees.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
This one device itself will bring about the destruction of the Union.
This is the equivalent of a nuclear weapon in the age of the Civil War.
It might as well be. I bet that was their justification.
But deterrent. There's nothing to this like even metaphor of the spider.
Nope.
Like there's nothing that Kenneth Branagh says about what the spider means to him. There's no connection at all to this spider that just appears.
If he could, I think Kenneth Branagh would have been like, ladies and gentlemen, I have nothing to do with
it. Hold on, guys. Kenneth Branagh just walked in the studio. We have a special guest right now, Kenneth Branagh.
I regret cheating on Emma Thompson so much. It's truly affected my career, all the way up to Thor.
It is. I mean, this spider is just, I mean...
That's the word you're looking for. It's total badass.
This movie might as well be called Gears and Pointless Contraptions. Because that is, every shot is just, the background is just moving parts.
Just like things are happening. Yes. Things.
And
a lot of money being spent in the background.
A lot.
No, by the way, being given to the foreground.
To the way, I almost think that like that Kenneth Branagh's character is John Peters. Because he's obsessed with Spider. Like he clearly has a thing for spiders. Yeah. Like they send a cake, a marzipan cake to the president, and oh, don't touch that. And all these spiders come out. Yeah. And it's like, oh. And then, you know, and then he has like special discs made up with a giant spider on it.
Yep, the blades. Yep.
But yeah, there's nothing like
his flag has a spider on it.
Yes, he is jumpy.
You know what's weird about that, man? Like the plates that have the spider on.
Yeah.
I understand the dude's rich, and I understand in movies to communicate impossible wealth, you see something like a giant spider.
Very Richie Rich style.
But could you imagine, it's like, even down to something like this disc is meant to be thrown away and destroyed.
Yeah.
Like, you're never going to see it again. Yeah. It launches. Whoever sees it is the person that loads the disc, and the next person that sees it is the person like,
gets his head cut off.
Coming at them, and that's that. Why would you bother to be like, imprint a spider on it?
Yeah.
Could you carve it in? It's going to cost us hundreds of dollars to do this.
It's going to cost especially you a little more. It's like, I know, but they mean so much to me. And you're not even involved in this transaction. You're not even like, I'm holding this disc of death with my spider emblem.
As a matter of fact, when he goes to kill them, he leaves. He doesn't even watch the disc get loaded and launched.
That's how fucking rich he is, dude. He's just like, put spiders on everything and kill people when I'm not here, man.
I do want to point out, you know, there's a part in the movie where you know Will Smith and Kevin Kline are caught. They're going to get their heads cut off by these spider discs. And I would say one of the most disturbing parts of the movie is when Kenneth Branagh talks about wanting to have sex with Salma Hayek with potentially his robot dick, in which I'll play for you right here.
Yeah.
Who knows? I might even become familiar with her myself.
That'd be one more reason for me to kill you.
Oh, yes, Mr. West. I'm sure to a no doubt, well endowed black and more like yourself, it must seem absolutely impossible that a freak like me could fully enjoy the pleasure of a woman. But having witnessed my use of mechanology thus far, wouldn't you think that I could devise something for the lower half of my body that was hard pumping and indefatigably steely? And speaking of hard pumping, Mr. Coleman, full steam ahead.
What?
Just talks about building a giant robot dildo to...
Do you think that was consummated by the time she was left? Because she stays with him on that train.
Well, she is pregnant, visibly pregnant with a robot baby
at
the end of the movie.
This movie...
Does he use a robot wiener on her?
Well, they've got that contraption.
He just took a jump.
Yeah.
I wish he did. And remember, when she's trapped in the birdcage in his house, the bed has all of those like sex contraptions. And she's like, I don't want to get on that. I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Like, it is clearly just like robot cock sexathon in this movie that we never see.
Although
we do see, I think we see Will Smith's balls from behind at the very beginning.
That's what I thought too.
Right?
Scream.
We definitely saw his nuts from behind.
Will Smith is naked in the beginning of the movie after bathing in a water tower.
He
lives. Which is not sanitary.
He appears to live in a water tower at the beginning of this movie.
They're hanging out in this giant water tower in the middle of town.
It's like a hot tub in the sky.
Which meanwhile is everyone else's drinking water, I would imagine.
Yeah. No, it's for fires, isn't it?
Oh, is it for fires? Okay.
I think so.
I thought thought it was drinking water. All right,
that would be disgusting.
Hey, back off, man. You're taking it into ridiculous realms.
We can put out our fires with cum-drenched water, but not put it in our mouths.
But yes, Will Smith's balls may or may not have made an appearance.
Definitely.
Well, there's a lot of ass in this movie, too. Salma Hayek's ass, Bai Ling's ass.
Bai Ling is, I mean, like a real favorite of this show.
Yes, Bai Ling, we are huge fans of Crank 2. We had the directors of Crank 2 in here, and we talked extensively about how amazing
she is. She's in that as well?
She's in that, and she threw away all the dialogue. Level. Oh, if you've not seen Crank 2... Do yourself a favor.
She threw away the dialogue?
Oh, yeah, she threw
and
away the dialogue.
And just started saying crazy shit. And they
were
like,
subtitled and she's
like,
speaking
well, what
in
do
English.
We do? And they were like, let's just let her do it. And
you'll go crazy if you
dude,
want
she's
it.
Unleashed.
Amazing.
She's unleashed.
Really?
Yeah.
It's unreal.
She's subtitled.
She's
in
Southland Tales. I was in Southland Tales as well, which I imagine one day you guys will get around to. And she was.
I feel like we're going
to
have you on for a bunch of shows.
Probably.
This is how we sneak you on for somebody else's movie.
Totally.
And then we get you hooked.
It's just like today's movie's Jersey Girl. Like, you guys suck. I guess it's my time.
Today we're doing Jersey Girl again today. We have Kevin Smith back.
Because Kevin's still not over.
But yeah, there's a lot of asses in this movie. Bai Ling, relatively restrained in this movie. But there's some crazy stuff in here. Again, the lynching scene. There's a scene where Will Smith is going to get lynched, but before he gets lynched, they let him do like a couple minutes of stand-up before he gets...
As you did in the Old West.
Yeah.
Sure.
Let's give
him
a couple...
Let him speak his mind!
There is such a dichotomy in this movie between like absolutely no attention paid to race and maximum attention paid to race in the worst way.
Well, that's the strange... It's like every about 15 minutes or so, the movie drops into some real historical social context that's very dark and upsetting. Yes. And then we're lifted right out of it a second later. It's the craziest...
With like some goofball invention from Kevin Klein.
That must have been the Pulp Fiction influence. We're like, no, we can go dark and then zip it right back to funny.
Well, like, I feel like the movie doesn't know. Like, it feels like it's one of those movies where it's like, we're funny and we're serious. And we're like, it's too much. It's trying to please too many people.
We don't know what we are, but we know one thing. We're not the Matrix.
Well, there's also in the end battle where they're in this giant spider, there's also a robot. Just a man, a Frankenstein man who is a robot that Will Smith tries to fight. He punches him in the face and you hear clang, punches him in the stomach, clang, punches him in the nuts, clang. And he's like, uh-oh, got a robot. And this robot's about ready to kick Will Smith's ass until, for no reason, he short circuits.
Yep.
To nothing of, no one did anything to him. Just.
Oh, I know what happened. Somewhere there's about 3 minutes of robot fight footage that like when they test screened it 8 times was so leaden. They were like, just pretend it's shorter. Like we're so close
to
the credits.
We've got to bring it home.
Come on.
I felt like a lot of times there was huge pieces of exposition missing that I was like, how did he get here? The movie appears to take place in about 72 hours.
Yes.
They travel across the United States. States
from DC to New Orleans,
to Utah.
Yeah, Utah.
I mean, like it's met the amount of space they travel, and there is so much dramatic, slow-moving train action. Like, the entire movie is attentive to the action as if it's like the French Connection car chase, but it is slow-moving single-track locomotives.
Right.
There is nothing happening on these trains.
There is a lot of time. Time has passed, and now this character's on the train. Wait, how did she get on the train? What happened?
They're like 2 days.
Selma Hayek drops in on that train. There's no explanation of how she got there.
Right,
I know how she got there. She was on the Dogma set. When she left, we were shooting Dogma, and she came in, and she was like, I got to the Wild Wild West.
Oh, my God.
And I was like, get out of here, man. That's a Will Smith movie. And she's like, oh, my God. And so they wanted her to go.
By the way, listeners, Selma Hayek is not in the studio. This is another flawless impression by auteur Kevin Smith.
I'm glad
I was like, oh, my God. It said nothing like Selma Hayek.
And I like that you went straight to Eichmann.
That's the most German I knew. But she got the part while we were making Dogma, and then she left early to go do fittings and do pre-shoot footage and stuff while she was shooting on the flick. So she'd come back, and we'd be like, what's it like, man? Because, again, these cats are coming off Men in Black, and Men in Black is a pretty amazing movie. So, you know, she was like, oh, it's going to be huge. I'm not even trying to work it.
It's really good. It is flawless.
It's terrible, man. It's falling apart. But she thought it was going to be very, very impressive, as we all did.
Yeah.
She came from our movie, went to that movie. And I remember going to see that movie and being like, I wish she'd stayed on our movie.
Did you have to cut her out of stuff in Dogma because she couldn't?
No, but I got a lot of people going like, I can't understand a fucking word she's saying. A lot of people couldn't follow the accent. Well, in the age of Bane, I don't feel so bad.
I feel
even
like
he was speaking English.
About Expendables 2. In the first 10 minutes, like, I don't understand what these guys are saying. Like,
really?
Yeah, because it's like everyone's it's like a lot of grumble. It's a lot of grumbling in the first 10 minutes.
A lot of low end.
Now, knowing your expertise, how come you didn't just ADR her lines yourself?
Jump in there and be like, I am a muse, dummy.
Well, they do that in Expendables 2. In Expendables 2, they ADR both people. Like Jet Li is totally ADR'd, and then I forget the woman in it. She is also just totally.
There's a woman in the Expendables?
Yes, I forget. I thought it was Maggie Q, but it's not.
Patricia Clarkson.
Yes, she's really put on a lot of muscle. Really strong.
Like, I don't know how this happened, but I got to tell you, it was a challenge.
Patty, we have an offer. It's Expendables 2.
By the way, I did actually just find out who played the character in Expendables. It is Nan Yoon. That's the famous Nan Yoon.
Oh, it's part of the Yoon cycle, is it? Oh, I can't believe I've missed Expendables 2. Did you like it?
I just bought a Yoon cycle. It is in the shop.
And you got to lean forward on it to make it work. Yeah. It's so, it makes you look really stuck up, but they move fast.
I did like Expendables 2 because I like movies like that, and it's dumb and
fun. Should we do it for this show?
You know, it would be like in the side of the good side, like the cranks and the punishment.
Thank God
stuff
this
like
got
that.
Made.
We love Fast Five. Like, it was like, yes, this movie is insane. It needs to be talked about, but we are loving it. And I mean, it's great. Schwarzenegger, amazing. Only talks and references to every other person's movie.
Really?
He says, I'll be back at least 3 times.
Oh my God.
And references Rambo, references, like, it's, the whole movie is just referencing That's everything amazing. That
Tell
they've
me
all
he
been.
He goes like, yippee-ki-yay.
He does.
No!
No!
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
By the way, listeners, you can tell that Arnold Schwarzenegger not in the studio.
Tell me in that scene, they cut to Bruce, and you just see a little bit more of his soul dying.
Well, you could tell. What I felt like was this. I felt like they shot Bruce Willis out in like 2 days. I also felt that they were like, okay, Bruce, would you say yippee-ki-yay? Because everyone's saying their catchphrases. You know, Van Damme does it. Schwarzenegger. Everyone
What's
does
Van
their
catch- catchphrase.
Like, come. Like, or, you know, from Bloodsport. Yeah. You know, like a very...
That's
like,
my catchphrase as well. With my old lady, I'm like, come. It never works. But I try it.
But everyone's like kind of reliving a moment of their past. And they were like, Bruce, will you say yippee-ki-yay in this moment? It kind of fit the moment. And he was like, no. And then they're like, all right, Schwarzenegger, will you say it instead? And he's like, yeah. Like,
basically, give me $1,000 and I'll say it. He's like, all right.
Basically, Bruce Willis walks off the screen and then Schwarzenegger goes, yippee-ki-yay.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
It's crazy. It was like, they were like, oh yeah, we'll just keep the same setup.
We gotta do that movie. And maybe our guest will be Kenneth Branagh to discuss it.
She knows Kenneth Branagh was doing so much wheelchair spinning in this movie.
Oh my God.
Oh yeah, well, Kenneth Branagh, every time he's on screen, he's just spinning in a circle at all times.
Round and round.
Oh man, there's. I'm just
like
trying
a record, baby.
Yeah,
round.
Also, June, you brought up a very good point here earlier when we were talking about this. Will Smith constantly ripping on Kevin Kline's inventions that work.
Yeah.
The inventions work the entire time. He's like, oh man, you and your crappy inventions. It's like, hey, you killed the guy with his invention. You got saved your life by his invention. No.
All the time. All the time it works.
Let's try a new plan, and maybe this time it'll work. It's worked every single time.
Every single time.
Every single time.
The bulletproof vest, the flying machine,
You're
dressing
as difficult
and drag.
To please as my mother.
How about the weird scene? How about the fucking scene where they are comparing fake tits?
I
love
and
that.
This is how the two heroes
I loved
bond.
Every second of that.
And
scene.
They're just like, you feel my boot, breast, whatever he's saying. Oh yeah. Oh, it feels. Oh, it feels terrible. It feels now. Try feeling my. And Emmett Walsh is watching the whole thing, and he's going, I knew it. You know, like, so
which
weird.
Yeah, it's so crazy, because what did he know? Did he think they're two
The minute they got
men?
On the train, he was like, uh-oh,
right,
couple
but,
of queers.
But, so he's thinking that two homosexual men are feeling each other's breasts.
Correct.
Yeah, because he's looking at it like they're saying, like, nice dick. Oh, yeah, I love your dick. It's
no,
not even
he hears them saying breasts. So he thinks that they're not men dressed as women. They're men feeling each other's male
actual
breasts.
Male, yeah.
Okay. All right.
And you're, you're in
now
that?
You okay. see why it's right. funny,
now
right?
Now I get it. Now I'm laughing.
I think when you make a movie like this that's meant to be as mainstream as that, like if you're spend, there should be a studio mandate in the rule book that says if you're going to spend upwards of, I would say 100, but let's bring it down to 75. Yeah. You have to have a representative from every generation that you're actually trying to court in the theaters on set when you're doing comedy. So you need a 10-year-old, a 20-year-old, a 30-year-old, 40-year-old, 50-year-old, 60-year-old, if you're going, if that's your demographic. And then you play that fucking, all right, the boys are going to feel each other's boobs. Yeah. And then you go down the line. 10-year-olds, is this good?
Liked it.
Totally. Yeah. 20-year-olds, is this still funny?
Yeah, pretty good.
30-year-olds, how are you feeling about
this? Not bad.
This is awesome. Yeah, yeah. I like working with an actor because suddenly you're in a seat. 40-year-olds, man.
All right, yeah, it's, really, you know, it's a little risque.
And then like suddenly it starts to fall apart. 50-year-olds?
You know, I could go do without the boob stuff.
And 60-year-olds.
I liked it.
Bring back that suit. Where's that spider?
I liked it.
But they should, man, because that's like I saw, did you see The Watch?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, The Watch has a moment in it where Vince Vaughn picks up a rushing nesting doll and opens it, and he's like, oh my God, there's another doll in here, in his Vince Vaughn way. Fine. One reveal, and I'll buy that this motherfucker has never heard of the concept of something within something. They carry this out, dude, all the way to the smallest. And you know, like there's a theory of comedy where the more you do it, like it's funny and then it's fucking dumb, then it goes back to being
this
funny.
This is the Mr. Show Thimble sketch.
This ain't that though. Yeah. This is like the exception that proves that rule, because you're like, please don't keep going.
Yeah. Oh,
please.
Yeah.
And you realize they left this in.
They thought it was awesome.
But if that's awesome, what the fuck did they cut out?
Oh,
and
yeah.
if you think that's awesome, you need to have a representative of every age group going like, I think this is shit. Like if you're sitting around doing the boob feeling joke and you got a 25-year-old kid there, he'd be like, dude, this ain't fucking funny.
Yeah.
Like have him stick his fist up his ass. Well, go, ooh, that's good. Let's do that instead.
Well, did you ever get notes the biggest studio thing, I guess Mallrats and then like Cop Out, right? Did you get those kind of notes on Cop Out when you were doing
it? Not until we started testing. They were pretty good. Like in terms of working, I always thought, I was taught that the studio is a great Satan and fucking like all they do is make crap. We make art, they make crap. And the philosophy that we were taught was they set out to make crap. They just want your fucking money. And I haven't worked inside, like, nobody. There's no Kenneth Branagh sitting in a spinning wheelchair fucking telling people, we're going to steal the audience's money with crap. They're all trying to do something that they think is good or funny or irrelevant or at least, you know, fucking popular or something like that. So having gone through the system with them, they were lovely. Like, I kept waiting for aha, these fucking bagels. You said there'd be everything, but there's just onion. I knew the studio lied. They were lovely.
You check that bagel plate every day.
Every day. Flip all side. Until post.
It's here. We're good.
Yeah, my bad. Right. So nobody touch it until I check the plate, please. So in post, once you start showing the movie and test screening, that's when they tend to get involved.
And then are you suggesting like, we got to make this bigger? We got
to
like...
Not bigger. Like, to be fair, like on Cop Out, we screened not like an official test screening, but one that we did at Warner Brothers. And so there were real people there, but it wasn't like a carded, you didn't like fill out or anything. So after that, like Jeff Robinoff was just like, look, man, there's a lot of funny stuff in the movie, but it just, the opening is so weak. He's going, so how would you feel about going back and reshooting an opening? And I wasn't like looking for a scapegoat, but he knew why the opening was weak. Like one of those dudes didn't want to be there.
Right.
So I was like, look, I'm happy to go back and shoot a new opening, but what's
still got that one dude?
What's going to be the difference? Don't you think the other dude's going? They're like, we'll handle the other dude. And we went back in December. The movie opened in February, right before Christmas, to New York, and shot three scenes, which are probably the funniest fucking scenes in the movie. One where Tracy gets punched in the dick by a little kid.
Yeah.
The opening where Bruce draws a dick on the window and shit. And then there's
three
else.
Dick scenes.
Very much. That's what was missing. We watched the movie. We're like, what's missing?
Scene with Ron Jeremy where he just shows his dick.
Where he's like, look. So we went back and we reshot, and I don't know what they did, man. Like, they literally had some kind of conversation with him because he was compliant and willing
to change everything.
Like, he was the guy that I thought I was going to work with the first time. And in this instance of we're going back and reshooting, I guess I wasn't there for the conversation, but I assume the conversation was something like, do you ever want to work at the studio again? Then you will go behave for 3 days while they fucking shoot three scenes.
Well, it was funny watching him in The Expendables, like, and again, just visually watching it, I'm like, oh, he was like, I'm gonna stand in this door frame, you're gonna get this one shot. Like, it was never, he didn't move. Pretty much all of his scenes is like standing, there's like two shots, one a little bit close and one a little bit far away.
Yeah. And is he ever like, tied in?
Two cameras, two? Both
never,
at the same time.
Never. He's never
so
tied in. Yeah.
He wasn't even there.
Yeah, it's just like, that's how I was like, it's so like, I mean, he's tied with Schwarzenegger, but it's just on them. But it's no other action is around him. Like, you could easily have shot that on a day.
I will light my hotel room while I'm shooting Looper. You guys will get what you get.
Bring a green screen in, bring Schwarzenegger to me.
There's definitely going to be a room service cart in the back of this scene.
Figure it out.
I do want to, just as we wrap up here, I do want to talk about the end of the movie. Basically, Kenneth Branagh like goes, he's going to give Will Smith a whooping, you know. And
there's, again, so much weird race stuff. The lynching, the whooping, all that stuff. And then inexplicably, this movie is like, just drops one N-word into the middle of the movie.
Where?
I can't remember it.
Doesn't Ted Levine have a line where he says he's the butcher of niggers?
Yeah.
That I was
the
like,
fuck out of
doesn't
here.
Doesn't he say that?
Yeah, because he killed his family.
Right? Yeah. Okay.
So you know, for that moment, like on set, they're going, look, we just got to take it real.
Yeah, we got to put something
real in this fucking art that's going to make people stop and think about what's happening in this movie.
And it doesn't
crazy.
Belong.
Because of course it's like, not. It's ridiculous.
It's like Batman and Robin. Like, we were talking about this last week when we did Batman and Robin. It's like that movie, it's like so over the top. There's cartoon sound effects, and then it's like, Alfred's dying. Oh, he's dying. It's like, whoa, why are we getting there? Like, we have Mr. Freeze doing puns, and we're gonna go into like a serious thing about
this
it dying.
This is all silly fluff.
Once again,
and all sort of crazy.
Pulp Fiction, dude. Just like, he did it. He was funny. Yeah. And then he could be serious.
He says the N-word. Yeah. How come Quentin Tarantino can use the N-word and we can't? It was so
because
that moment
because you've
was
got
mental.
An 8-year-old watching that movie. Yeah. It's PG-13, which means conceivably you could see a kid to go see that movie. Bring a kid.
Oh yeah.
So you're watching it, giant fucking mechanical spiders. I mean, honestly, an 8-year-old is probably going to be the target audience.
Sure.
Like, this looks cool, and I'm bored when adults talk in real life. So when they talk here, I'm also bored. But at least they got giant spiders. But at that point, suddenly they drop that line.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. And that's a serious thing. He killed all these people. Yeah. He killed Will Smith's parents.
Will Smith's character was an escaped slave. At the age of
as a child,
four?
he was taken from his family.
Lived with Indian,
which is not
the story of Wild Wild West.
No,
right?
No, because Wild Wild West, he's a white guy.
Yeah.
So
essentially, they're doing the story of Django Unchained.
It is.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
it is
absolutely. Django Unchained.
And then, ironically, Will Smith
was offered.
Didn't want to do.
And because he'd already done it, Wild Wild West. he's like, I've done this movie. It's called Wild Wild West, and I'm very proud of it.
Can't improve on it. I was watching this movie going,
does your movie have a giant spider, Quentin? No.
That's why Quentin. When it took so long, that's the end of Django now. The giant spider
comes back. They come
Christoph
across.
Waltz is in it.
They come across the giant spider that had died in this movie, right? And they come across it, they revive it, and the rest of the movie takes place in that.
What they do is they find all those plates with the spider emblem buried into them, and they build a new spider from the wreckage.
I would love like a weird film joke if people just started putting props from this movie in other movies.
In Old West movies?
As if it was like archaeologists discover these plates with spiders on them.
Well, and all the ladies had spider dresses at the big ceremony.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
now you know why. It's because John Peters, the producer, and he's just like, kids love spiders.
Well, John Peters also, not John Peters, but Will Smith also plays Muhammad Ali in a movie.
John Peters. Yeah.
Really?
Yes, same guy.
His name's on it.
Oh, that's interesting.
What did he have to do with it? That depends. As I said before, I know he's involved with Batman. I know he's involved with Main Event because he can tell you lots of stories.
But his
he
name could be on a lot of things.
He took credit for on Batman. This blew my mind. This is what I instantly fell in love with John Peters in a way of like you fall in love with fucking wacky dictators who aren't going to affect your life anymore because you're going to fucking never be in contact with them again. I was a big Batman fan, Batman fan of Tim Burton's 1989 Batman. So whenever he talked about it, I was head in my hands listening and shit. And he would say things like, I was going out with Vicki Vale, right? And I was like, really? Did you have the Joker over for dinner? Yeah. Like, you could say her name, dude. I'm aware that Kim Basinger played Vicki Vale. But he said this. He goes, I said, one of the things I love in that movie, dude, is so fucking tight, is when the dude pops over the wall and starts fighting and Batman blocking his sword with his gauntlets. And he goes, that was mine. And I go, really? He's going, I brought that guy in. That guy's a real sword fighter. You know why that movie made $300 million? And I go, why? He goes, that scene. And I go, why? He goes, because that was real Jeopardy. And that guy came over the wall with the swords, man. You got to see Batman in action. Yeah. And so that's why that movie works.
That,
that scene, when you watch Tim Burton's Batman, realize it's nothing. It's not the story.
Nope.
It's not Anton Furst city design, the Batmobile, the moody performance by Michael Keaton, Jack Nicholson's sublime Joker.
Prince's
no dude.
But soundtrack. Prince's
soundtrack.
But you know,
it literally comes down to the guy who jumps
sword
over
fighter.
The wall and throws a few bad swords.
Not to rip on Bruce Willis, but when I heard Bruce Willis talk about Die Hard, he goes, the reason why people like the original Die Hard is because he likes, the people like the humor of a New Jersey guy caught in this situation. It's like, I don't know if that's the catch-all of why that movie is successful. The Jersey humor of John McClane.
He's distilled it down to this. He's like, you know why that made money? Because of me.
Yeah.
So that's it. Essentially, that's what he's
saying. And what is it about me? It's probably because I'm from Jersey.
My Jersey humor. People really like, I like that Jersey humor. The end of the movie, you know, the main character has his like final line, like, you know, diplomatic immunity, whatever. And this one.
Final line. Diplomatic immunity.
Yeah, that's Lethal Weapon 2. been revoked. But
diplomatic
this,
immunity.
This one, he just basically throws Kenneth Branagh out of the giant spider, and then he goes, now that's a whooping.
Yeah.
But it really isn't.
Nope.
It's more of like, that's a throw-in.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It was like, they couldn't they have found a way to whip him with some chains or do... Like, if you want... If you're going to end on a line...
And
you should have
or make use somehow of him having a half body.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I thought that was... Gonna play into his death at somehow in the end. Not at all.
And by the way,
like if only I'd had a leg, I could have lived.
Every bad guy in this movie, Ted Levine, that's his name, right?
Yes.
And Kenneth Branagh. All the bad guys have such uneventful deaths,
mm-hmm.
and deaths that are so circumstantial to the good guys. The good guys barely do any. Like,
yeah.
It's almost like they were like, well, our guys can't really kill people. So we'll have Kenneth Branagh's people shoot Ted Levine, and then Will Smith can have a comeuppance with him, but he's already dead.
Right.
And then Kenneth Branagh and Will Smith both fall out of the spider, and Will Smith just doesn't save Kenneth Branagh, so he dies. So it's like, they never, meanwhile, they're shooting, Will Smith shoots like 2,500 people in this movie.
Yeah. He's always killing people. The only person he meets his match with is the Frankenstein, which is not explained,
yes.
and then short circuits.
Well, and in terms of story, you would think that final beat had something to do with Will Smith like accepting industry in his life and accepting somehow that the gadgets were going to help him. No, it boils down to race at the last moment, which is not what this movie's about.
Nope.
Now, clearly, we had an opinion about this movie, but there are people who have a different opinion, so it is now time for a second opinion. These are reviews culled from Amazon. I just would like to read you guys this one. Ed B. writes, honestly, this is in my top 100 favorite movies of all time.
Wow.
Out of the thousands that I have seen.
Wow.
5-star review.
That's huge.
I
like that guy. I want to show him my work.
This is another great one. Evan Orozco writes, Wild Wild West is the greatest and most funniest movie in the world. A true classic. The best of the best. Bai Ling is so sexy and has the sexiest ass. Buy this movie. 5 stars. And then this
most
is
funniest negates that entire review.
And
I'm
then,
a grammar Nazi, and most funniest, he lost me at that point.
But it is the most funniest.
It is.
To be
Come
fair.
On, you guys.
To be fair.
Perilous Moo writes, this movie was great. The interactions between Will Smith and Kenneth Branagh are a piece of comedic cinema history.
Oh, my
but
God.
But it would have been nice to have a good female character. Put someone like Madeline Kahn or Bernadette Peters in a
what?
Role. It would have been pants-wettingly funny.
Did my grandmother write this letter during while she was watching the Carol Burnett show?
I was just going to say, Vicki Lawrence should be in this movie.
And then
what was missing was
Mama.
Harvey Korman.
And he writes, Mel Brooks seems to be the only director who understands how to cast women in comedies. 5 stars.
No, still 5 stars. Still 5 stars. I have some problems, but still 5 stars.
He's generous. Mel Brooks did it.
Madeline Kahn.
Wow.
Well, this has been so great to have you, Kevin. I was talking to you before we started talking about the show. I am obsessed with your new show on Hulu called Spoilers. This is not even this is a legitimate, I am a fan of this show. It's so fun to watch.
Thank you.
You bring a bunch of people to a movie, you talk about it honestly, and then you interview someone from.
It's fun. It's fun. If you haven't seen it yet, you could pop over to Hulu. It's free. You can watch it. And it's trying to do like to a not a movie review show, but a show about movies that where you could talk about movies, but not like, here's our scale, and it gets this, and blah, blah, blah.
I think
blah.
It's the best way to watch a movie review show, just have an audience, because it's like different people, and you're like, oh, I like that guy, or like, it's a fun, I've never
seen it. And think about, like, Siskel and Ebert were two strangers who you grew to know over years as, oh, they review movies, but it's not like they were, you know, fucking experts or worked in the business or something like that. People will say, Roger Ebert wrote fucking Beyond the Valley. I understand. Yeah. He's done some work as well. But in that way, there was, like, you were listening to people pontificate. When you watch spoilers, it's more about like you're watching people, real people,
talk about
yeah. And it's also kind of like the way you talk about movies with your friends, where like even shit you hate, you don't go like, oh, it was a cinematic abortion, no stars, thumbs down. You just go like, this part was awesome, this part was fucking stupid.
Let's that's what we do something. Here.
That's pretty much, you know.
Same thing.
So definitely check out spoilers. Today's episode is actually sponsored by Roy McClurg, who donated some money to the podcast. Thank you, Roy. And a big reminder to watch NTSF SDSUV. It is the show that I do on Adult Swim with June. This week's episode is a Martin episode. Allison Brie is in this episode. It's one of my favorites. It's called Sabotage, A Return of Carrie Kinney. So definitely check that out at 12:15. Jason's coming up in an episode in a little
bit. Yeah.
And
Children's Hospital back on the air.
Children's Hospital, yes. Great stuff. So check out Adult Swim Thursday night.
We have Alan Ackerman on.
Who is so funny and so great. So thanks to everybody. Thanks to Brett, our engineer, Carolyn, Julia, everybody here at Earwolf. Buy our Biling inspired How Did This Get Made t-shirts. We'll see you next time. Bye bye.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio Boom.com. The wolf dead.
This February, true legends from the worlds of comedy and music will unite to form the Supergroup. I'm Tawny Newsome. On every episode, me and my co-host, Alex Kleiner, will invite our talented friends to write and record an original song with us over the course of a week.
You'll hear every step of the process, from writing and rewriting to recording and mixing. Songs with Open Mike Eagle, Paul F. Tompkins, Ted Leo, Woo! Sashir Zameda, Janet Woo! Barney, and more.
The Supergroup. Join the band February 6th on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen.